Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
It's the story of a cultural superpower that danced and sprinted its way to success. It brought the world reggae, Colin Powell, Rastas, hip-hop, Bob Marley, and much more. Its story is told to you in full color for your podcasting ears. It's the story of how Jamaica conquered the world. Search for it on iTunes, How Jamaica Conquered the World. It's probably the best least-known podcast in podcastdom. Search for it today.
An das deutsche Volk. Seit der Reichsgründung ist es durch
1914, June, Sarajevo. The heir to the throne of Austria-Hungary, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, assassinated, killed by a Serbian nationalist. About 6 weeks later, World War breaks out. Germany, Austria-Hungary, Russia, France, Britain, everyone is drawn into it starting in August, and then will America be drawn in?
Listen to the first show exclusively on Mixcloud today and subscribe to us on iTunes beginning January the 18th. From Washington to Obama, 10 American Presidents, the new podcast from Royfield Brown.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Hello and welcome to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. I'm Barbara.
And I'm John. And this week we're talking about how transport makes the city.
Sometimes you're in a long stretch of traffic. You get to the front and you realise that there's been a small accident where both cars could have gone to the side of the road, but they're both angry at each other and are kind of causing this like miles long stretch of traffic.
Someone dusted off an old plan and it was decided on that we're going to build this with the political narrative to rebalance the economy, which is a fair objective to meet.
What sucks about Leeds, our local and national politicians don't seem to be willing to just grab opportunities by the cojones.
So regular readers, if they've ever bothered to check this stuff, will notice we, in theory, have five sections on the website, one of which is transport. But I think it's probably fair to say that transport isn't just a fifth of our coverage, that actually it's probably more like, I don't know.
Half.
Yeah, half is probably about
70%.
Yeah, I mean, on a good day, it's all of it. But I think there's two reasons for that. One is that, you know, you people are really into this stuff. Let's not lie to ourselves here.
Well, yeah, if we look at the stuff people actually read, yeah. Again, the percentage is very high.
Yeah, we're shameless capitalists like that. But the other thing is, I think transport networks are actually quite fundamental to how cities function. Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of easy to imagine that, you know, a city is the sort of the built up area, but actually in practice they can kind of be bigger than that, because a commuting zone is a better functional definition for a city. And, you know, a whole load of cities have kind of grown out as their transport map has grown.
My thought, as you were saying, was that was also that it can be smaller than that, because to me, maybe because I'm kind of young and broke in London, the difference between a inner city commuting, well, not even a commuting zone, just a transport zone, and then, I mean, if you looked at London from above, you might start seeing bits of the home counties kind of lit up as well. But for that, that's kind of a vastly different price range. And I think the kind of the virtue of cities is actually that you can travel for an hour for £1.40 and you're still within the city, but actually you're traveling much further than you'd ever bother to do if you lived in some provincial town. You wouldn't do that every day just to see your friend, whereas cities allow you to do that.
But I guess what I'm getting at really is, like, I grew up in the sort of outer suburb of London, and it took, you know, better part of an hour to get into town. Other people live in commuter towns, you know, much further out, and it still takes about an hour to get into town. And, you know, functionally, in terms of how you relate to the city, is there really any difference between those two positions?
Yeah, no, not really. And especially since, I mean, it depends what city you're in. Some cities are more driver-friendly, but given that in London it's completely pointless really driving. So you are really, your geography is basically dictated by what transport is doing. And I think in our heads we see different parts of the city. This probably goes for quite a lot of places. In fact, maybe New York is another example, where the areas of the city you consider being accessible, that is totally related to the transport links. It's got very little to do with the actual distances involved.
Mm. So there's the old joke about, you know, cabs not wanting to go south of the river. And I think, like, one of the reasons South London is, until very recently, still seen as, like, this kind of weird, remote, inaccessible place is because the tube doesn't go down there very much.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's less, it's forms of transport everyone's less familiar with. So buses and the overground rail, where the map is just not as familiar.
Yeah, and I mean, I suppose a lot of that just had to do with the fact the ground was very marshy, which meant that those kind of very deep underground lines took a lot, weren't as straightforward to do.
Oh, good geological fact there.
I know. That's... Well, this is all based on the fact that someone once told me that Southwark Station is basically floating, that a lot of those Jubilee Line stations use quite complex engineering to be able to kind of move with the kind of soil levels, because the whole thing is just a complete mush.
That is awesome. You actually you just taught me something about the tube I didn't know. That's amazing.
We should probably fact check it afterwards, but I think it is true, and that's why it took such a long time, and that's why those stations look quite futuristic, because in fact they're very complicated.
You mentioned New York. One of the things I quite like about this, so the map of New York is, or quite like, is the wrong phrase, but one of the things that strikes me about it is, like, the subway network just stops at the city boundary. So if you look at the Northern Bronx, like, the lines just kind of stop at the very northern end of New York City itself, even though the built-up area continues into, what's the county? Westchester County, I think it's called. The city itself is defined by the subway, and the subway is defined by the city.
What's interesting, though, as well, is cities where the transport link comes kind of later. So Beijing, for example, where the subway grew, or the metro grew up very quickly, but kind of after the city had already established its limits. I wonder if that changes the way that places develop. I don't know. It probably is a two-way street.
Yeah, no, I think that you're right. There are two different models, because certainly London, and I think a lot of the other sort of cities of that sort of age kind of grew with their metro map. So, like, London, a lot of the outer tube lines were built as a... It was a real estate business, really. You kind of build a tube line so that you could sell the houses that you built next to the tube line. But that's totally different from the model in a lot of big Asian cities, where they're kind of trying to impose a metro network on something that's already there. The point I was kind of getting at the start of this was that, you know, there is no standard definition of a city. It's incredibly difficult to come up with standardized population figures so that you can directly compare, I don't know, Vienna and Baghdad or something, because how do you decide where the city stops? And one of the only, one of the most common definitions that people do use is commuting patterns, because if, you know, 75% of the population of an area commute into the city to work, then functionally they are residents of the city, even if they're kind of living 10, 15, 20 miles away. So, to an extent, our transport networks do exactly define what a city is.
Yeah, and they allow for that strange effect whereby you have kind of the centres of cities like London and New York, which during the day have massive populations at their centre, and then at night have this kind of donut effect of where the population kind of all goes back again to these faraway places. And that is only allowed for by these networks in the first place.
But this is kind of a 20th century thing. Like,
yeah.
Once upon a time, cities were... could only get so big because you literally couldn't get to the other side of them on foot if they're any bigger. So it's really only sort of transport, metros and so on, that kind of enabled this sort of ballooning of cities into the kind of urban sprawl we know today.
Yeah, and also I think there's a strange effect whereby people who live in the centre of London, this is now a very expensive and desirable thing to do. Whereas in the past, I think living right kind of in what would be the centre, now imagine the centre of international cities, wasn't kind of so exciting and great.
No, this is definitely a very recognisable trend. There's kind of an inflection point in the 90s where suddenly city centres, which have been hollowed out of population for decades, suddenly become fashionable places to live again. I wrote a slightly sarky piece blaming it on Friends. I genuinely think there is a cultural moment in the early 90s where suddenly living downtown becomes aspirational again, and things like Friends and Seinfeld and Sex and the City and so on are actually a part of that. But I think probably the main reason is just that heavy manufacturing stopped being the main way cities made money, and people don't want to live next to factories, but living next to
office blocks.
Yeah, is you're not going to choke on the stuff coming out of Goldman Sachs.
Well, maybe abstractly, but
metaphorical terms, yeah. Perhaps. So a lot of cities now are growing spontaneously. They're not growing in the sort of, I mean, the cities built around metro networks weren't planned exactly, but there was people built the rail links and then the houses, and then people moved into those houses. What's happening now in much of the developing world is that cities are growing because people move to them and build their own houses. And it's often quite difficult for the transport network to keep up. So what does that look like?
My name is Emmanuel Akinwotu. I'm a journalist, freelancing at the moment at The Guardian. I write on Nigeria.
You wrote a fascinating piece for us about the yellow bus network, which is kind of just a semi-informal network. Do you want to tell us about that a little bit?
It's one of those things that really epitomises the way the city works. So you get on these networks, there isn't a map, you can't go online and Google how to get from one place to another. But when you go to your local bus stop, it's a bus stop because basically people are standing around in one place, and and that is the kind of key indication. And the buses, they kind of stop by each stop, and they usually have, in every bus, there's usually a bus driver and a conductor. The conductor is usually this young person who stands outside the side of the bus and kind of shouts the destinations at people, trying to get them to come in. And he also kind of takes care of the money inside the bus. And to get on the bus can be difficult because Lagos buses are characteristically impatient. So they won't really stop for you to get in. They'll just kind of slow a bit. And the second you've got like one leg on, they're like back up to 50 miles an hour away to the next bus stop. Trains are scarce, and a lot of the train lines, really, a train maybe comes like a few times a day, not very well connected. So transport is solely reliant on roads, which are always packed, which have enough problems. So it just makes the bus network a complete kind of, sometimes a bit of a basket case.
I have always lived in London, basically, but I think London is fairly typical of major cities in that people get so used to certain transport links being there that, you know, if the Central Line or the A train or whatever it is goes down, then they get very angry because they can't get to work.
Yeah.
But that's because they're so sort of used to knowing they are 45 minutes from their destination.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like there's that level of predictability. I mean, how do you commute in a city like Lagos when you have no idea how long it's going to take you every day?
So broadly, you're able to kind of make predictions. But the problem really is anything can happen at any time. And that's the frustration. You know, sometimes I remember a journey that should have taken me about 2 hours. I ended up being 3 hours late. You know, and you get
3 hours late.
3 hours late. Yeah.
So it's 5 hours.
It took
overall.
Me 5 hours to make a 2 hour journey. And sometimes you're in a long stretch of traffic and you think, oh, it's just kind of classic Lagos congestion. It's a terrible morning. And you get to the front and you realize that there's like been a small accident where both cars could have gone to the side of the road, but they're both kind of angry at each other and are kind of causing this like miles long stretch of traffic, and you get these kind of menial motley little problems that can be so disruptive on the road, largely because of the way that the system on the road is. It's so poorly managed and it's so kind of a law unto itself that it really needs a kind of, in some sense, a culture change, but also it needs better administration. One of the things that causes a lot of traffic is just poor roads. You can go down a road and maybe it should theoretically take you like 5 minutes to drive down, and it could take you five times that long because potholes on the road basically make it so that you can't drive more than a few miles per hour in practice. And it's these kind of things that make transport so difficult, unnecessarily difficult in Nigeria.
It sounds like there's kind of two layers of difficulty here. There's the sort of the absence of infrastructure, the fact that everyone is dependent on these roads because there's not a metro system or something. But also there's an absence of kind of almost of institutional or cultural infrastructure. So, like, you get these two guys arguing on the road because there is no system in place, whether it's cultural norms or like local traffic wardens or something, who can actually come out and disrupt that and sort of get it moving again.
Where Lagos have actually tried to help is they've many years ago had this system called LASMA. This is this road network system where these kind of officials are policing the road actively, and they have a good reputation of being quite stern guys that you don't really want to cross. They're quite strict, and you know, they can, you can be fined for making misdemeanors on the road. But naturally, there's so many cars to very few men and women on the road that, you know, a lot of things happen beyond their kind of jurisdiction. But largely, what they do try to do is make the system work better than it does, and they have a good impact. I think the real problem is that they're not enough. One of the ways the new governors try to kind of toughen up road laws is they've created these things called mobile courts. Essentially, they'll, if you, for example, drive down a one-way street on the opposite way, which actually happened to me, was in a car and my driver, the taxi driver, went down the opposite way on a one-way street. And, you know, he kind of realized, but was like, ah, sod it, sort of. and went down, and a LASMA official stopped him. And we stopped by the side of the car, and they had to, he essentially had to pay a fine for it. And, but, you know, he was in a sense fortunate, because should that happen since this year, what they would do is they'd take him immediately to this court, which would give him a much heftier fine on the spot. And the consequences for not paying it could, in some cases, lead to jail time. So they've really kind of beefed up the road laws. But these mobile courts that they have, there are only five of them in a city of about plus 21 million people.
21 million is almost, you know, unimaginable.
So it's like, whilst the policy seems okay in terms of trying to, you know, it's in practice, it's not really that effective. Mm. The best way to make Lagos transport work better, smoother and quicker is just to make, firstly, to improve road quality. But I think also the way the infrastructure works is not great. There are so many buses that are going down very small residential streets, largely because connectivity in these streets is so bad. And I think, and that in turn makes roads that are really not really built for heavy traffic to go down them, it makes them get worse and worse. And I think what they need to do is they need to improve connectivity in and around the city, so big buses don't have to go down small streets. And also so that there isn't as heavy a reliance on road transport. People can take a train, for example. But that, at the moment, seems like a bit of a pipe dream.
So there's no sort of plan for like a huge Lagos metro network?
There's been this kind of recurring thing since like the early 90s. You know, they talk about it a lot, about the Lagos train networks. And they are saying now that it will be ready very soon, within the next few years. There is a train network, but it's so scarce that it's pointless to go on, and people don't trust it, and people know that they don't really come. And that's why quite often on train links, there are markets. And in the rare occasion that a train
actually
comes...
Actually on the rails?
On the rails. So in the rare occasion that a train comes along, you know, you can move your goods to the side and come back and know that, as I said, maybe a day before one turns up again. And the problems that come from the overpopulation is very difficult for any single government to get a grip over. You know, and that's been the major challenge. I mean, Lagos was about 1.4 million people in the early 70s. It's now over 20, at least it says officially 21, but it could be anything up to 25. It's one of the fastest growing cities in the world. Housing, for example, is another problem where, even though the government have tried, made tentative steps towards building more houses, the problems of overpopulation just means all those steps just get dwarfed more and more each year. And even with now trying to improve road transport, it's still an issue, because road development and transport development is a lot slower than population growth. I think what they should do from a public policy perspective is they need to kind of really get a handle on road infrastructure, really invest a lot in it, in the administering of it. A big problem in previous governments had been corruption in building roads. A road would be, the government would already, you know, have it set that they would have a road that was ready for redevelopment. And quite often a road would start being built, and then when it's like three quarters of the way, you just kind of see the construction workers have disappeared. And that happens a lot. That happened a lot. And it was a kind of corruption scheme.
The money ran out.
Yeah, it wasn't so much the money ran out as in it wasn't there. It was that the people who were supposed to use the money for the roads kind of disappeared.
Mm.
So it was like a lot of roads were being commissioned to be rebuilt, but the commissioning was what was happening, not the administering of those construction sites. And that was a massive problem. The current governor's tried to tackle that in the sense of really essentially going around in his car and checking on the sites personally, and having a tighter grip on that. And it worked in some places. In a lot of places on the mainland that had been waiting on roads to be built, has the last time I went in a few weeks ago, you could see that those roads had made a lot of progress since he's been there. So there is steady progress, but again, in a city with that many people, the progress only really, it needs a better system of government that these institutions, government institutions, can have a greater trust in the way these things work. But usually it relies on a kind of strongman individual coming in and beefing everyone into action.
So Emmanuel suggested that big kind of fancy road projects could be one solution for this kind of sort of formlessness of the transport network. Do we think that would work?
I mean, I'm cynical for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, cars are kind of on their way out. Like, it's just, yeah, they're just rubbish, really, aren't they? I mean, just build some trains. Trains are way cooler.
Get a lot more people in the train.
Yeah. They are a more efficient use of space. And, you know, also people like the maps, but mostly the more efficient use of space and energy and so on. But the other thing is actually, like, it just felt a bit in one bound they were free to say all they need to do is sort of invest a lot more in the roads.
And I guess the other problem is you need to think about the environment in which you're operating, that even the sort of most powerful governments struggle with these projects all the time.
Yeah. There are very good reasons why big projects on that scale don't quite come off.
Next station is Hu Xing Mun. Hu Xing Mun is a transfer station. Passengers for line 2, please prepare to get off.
Hello, my name's Nicole Badstuber. I'm a researcher at the London School of Economics, and I'm also a doctoral student at University College London. My research is looking at transport in cities and how they're governed.
Okay, so there is this thing called the mega projects, which these are the multi-billion pound engineering schemes, public or road transport. And other than the expense, the thing that seems to sort of bind them together as a group is this sort of assumption that we just build this one thing and all our problems will be solved and we'll live happily ever after. And that doesn't actually tend to happen. Like, the mega project as a category tends to be known for everything costing far more than you expect and it taking far longer to build. And, you know, but why do these things go wrong? Why are there so few examples of these mega projects that kind of stay on time and on budget?
So the mega project inherently is very risky. The long period over which it's planned and then implemented makes it very prone to sort of be knocked out of the path it's supposed to be going down. It also means any event that you may not think actually affects it does. So for instance, if a different part of railway in the country falls down or a highway collapses, suddenly all the safety factors increase, or suddenly the perception of the project changes and we have to, you know, do a lot of contingency measures to mitigate that perceived concern. Also, politicians can influence it a lot. So one of the big things is that once you start changing a lot of the plans at the implementation phase, that really pushes up the cost of projects, because what was planned for and costed for is now completely different to the scope that is being demanded. and contractors can push up the price. The plans that were made are no longer valid. So interruptions, basically, because of the period over which it's being built is so long, interruptions along the way can really influence it. And because a mega project is so large and is built over such a long time, it is really prone to that happening. Also, there is a lot of optimism bias, especially when it is being planned. So even though places like the UK have a Green Book, which is a book, a guidance on how to cost projects and how to try and reduce the optimism bias, it still always happens that people planning these projects are very optimistic about what may be achieved, what objectives can be realised. So for transport projects in particular, you know, how many people are going to use the system immediately?
So is the point that because it's such a long time horizon and such a big project that any modelling you do is going to be built on a whole series of nested assumptions, and by making slightly different assumptions you can come up with radically different end numbers. So basically you can kind of not fiddle the figures exactly, but like you can get the result you want to a certain extent. I mean, is there a problem that if you've spent a couple of years in your life working on the planning phase of a project like this, you don't want the answer to be, no, we shouldn't build this thing, because then you've just wasted the last 3 years of your life?
Yes, I guess a good example of that would be HS2, where the decision has been made to build that. And
so HS2 for overseas...
Sorry, High Speed 2.
The proposed high-speed rail link from London to the north of England.
Anecdote around it is that someone dusted off an old plan at the DfT and it was decided on that we're going to build this with the political narrative to rebalance the economy, which is a fair objective to meet. But then a series of trying to justify that within the procedures and processes we have in place to justify or to make a case for it was used after the decision was made that this is the project to go for. So rather than it being, look, here is a problem, how can we address the problem? How can we look at finding different solutions that may meet that identified problem? The solution is decided, and then the sort of problem retrospectively.
So everything is back to front. You've got solutions in search of a problem rather than the other way around. Are there any examples of good mega projects that haven't gone horribly, horribly wrong? And what's different about them?
So one that's often used at the moment is that Crossrail is going quite well. So what is said that is working quite well is that a lot of the planning was done at the planning stage. The route hasn't been changed. And that there was enough technical expertise in the whole mechanism building Crossrail to ensure that it is working well. By comparison to projects that, you know, are going tenfold over budget or threefold over budget.
Crossrail being a new underground railway across London. I grew up on one of the stations that will be served by... No, I didn't grow up on the station, that would be ridiculous. I grew up near one of the stations. There speaks a transport researcher. I grew up in one of the areas in sort of outer East London that will be served by Crossrail. And I remember in my childhood there being leaflets at the local station announcing that Crossrail was being proposed.
Yep.
Now, firstly, the route suggested then was not the route we're getting now. And secondly, I'm really getting on a bit. So this is going back some time. I mean, like, it feels to me like there was this sort of 20-year period where Crossrail sort of went back and forth without being signed off, in which there was probably quite a lot of public money spent on proposing the thing before they actually signed it off in the early 21st century. So I don't know, I'm speculating. I just wonder whether it's kind of easy to look at a project and say, oh, this hasn't been too bad, if you don't start counting until quite late on.
The journey that there has been to get to this point where we may have Crossrail or a line from east to west has been a long one, and obviously there have been some route changes, but I think in comparison to other projects, once the decision was actually finally made to build it, the project managers seem to have learnt from some of the mistakes done elsewhere in mega projects. To go back to why it's taken so long, that is based on the political cycles and the election cycles, which mean that politicians have their eyes on projects that can be realised within their term, and mega projects can't. So the person cutting the ribbon won't be you, it will be someone 20 years down the line.
And human nature being what it is, it's probably quite easy then to think, well, there are other good reasons not to spend this several billion pounds or dollars, yeah, or whatever it may be. How big a problem is technical expertise? Because presumably most people who work on one of these projects are not going to have worked on another one. Is there just a problem that people don't know how to run these things?
Right. That is a problem that is often highlighted as one of the reasons that the Jubilee Line extension, which went from central London to the new financial district in Canary Wharf, was such a large cost overrun, because that was the first project within decades that there just wasn't the knowledge and the management skill to deal with such a big project, and to manage all of the contractors that were involved in that project. A mega project by design is very complex, and you need a good management structure in place to make sure there is the right communication when problems crop up, and that wasn't in place. The technical expertise to deal with those problems once they cropped up was also not in place. So, yes, you're right, that is a major problem. So people advocate for having a more continuous stream of mega projects, and I guess is one of the arguments for now starting to look at Crossrail 2, is that expertise can be captured and reused to make sure the next project is also a success.
Are mega projects just bad? Should we stop trying to do these things because the human race is just not capable of spending $10 billion without accidentally spending $30 billion? Should we just focus on smaller projects?
Academics at Oxford University, Fluberg and his colleagues, argue that we should try and break down maybe the project into smaller chunks which are more manageable. That you could maybe break down the mega project into smaller components, which are more accessible and more easily realisable.
But how do you build a Crossrail or an HS2 or an RER or an East Side Access project? How do you build those like a bit at a time?
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge.
The conversation actually continued after that, and Nicole explained various ways in which you can address some of these problems. You can break these projects into pieces and do a bit of a long-distance railway line at a time, although how you do that for a big tunnel, I don't know. Or you can set up some kind of national commission that kind of takes the big infrastructure projects out of the political process. But I just don't see how you can ever completely depoliticize.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Projects that are going to cost billions in taxpayer money. I just don't see it happening.
Now we're moving on to the portion of the show where someone tells us about their city, and this week we're looking north.
Hi, I'm Tim Oliver. I'm a university lecturer and I live in Leeds, and I want to tell you what's great and what sucks about Leeds. What's great about Leeds is that the people who live here have managed to make it a pretty darn good place. So there's loads of different places to go and eat, go and drink, loads of different stuff to go and do, lots of creative, dynamic people doing creative, dynamic things. But this links to what sucks about Leeds. What sucks about Leeds is that compared to particularly one of the major northern cities, Manchester, our local and national politicians don't seem to be willing to just grab opportunities by the cojones and take them forward. I think there's a degree of envy of Manchester. If you look at what Manchester Council under Richard Leese has done for Manchester, if you look at things like the Metrolink, if you look at the city deal that Manchester got, there's just a feeling that Manchester's generally got a council that's willing to go out and do stuff, whereas Leeds City Council is stuck in petty squabbles with its neighbours about who gets to be in what club when it comes to local government deals. So in many ways, what's great about Leeds is often in spite of what sucks about Leeds. And it would be nice if what sucked about Leeds sorted itself out so we can make what's great about Leeds even greater.
This is a Manhattan-bound B skip-stop train. The next stop is Sheepshead Bay.
We're on the hunt for more people to tell us their favourite and less favourite things about their city. So if you would like to appear, just get in touch with us by Twitter or by email, and we'd love to have you on.
To wrap up, we are going to talk about our map of the week. And this week, I'm going to say as regular readers will know again, sorry, but as regular readers will know, we do also publish quite a lot of amateur takes on famous metro maps, particularly London's Tube Map. Which is kind of if you're a designer wanting to show off your skills, showing your take on London's Tube Map seems to be one of the avenues to do that. The reason I mention all this is that one of the guys who came to us with his own take on the Tube Map has actually succeeded in making one of his amateur maps official. A Serbian guy called I'm going to massively mispronounce his name here, Jug Serovic, produced an amateur bus map of Luxembourg City. And it's now been adopted by the city government. It's the official version. I mean, Jug is actually a professional designer. He's not just some random map maker. But, you know, I think it gives hope to all those people out there sort of tinkering
with
their own.
Yeah, I think so. And also, I suppose people like maps because they're a bit like puzzles, especially where, so on the Luxembourg map, there were just tons and tons of lines just all kind of running alongside each other. And it just made you feel a bit kind of sick to look at. And he just kind of gradually detangled them. Mm-hmm. And he did so effectively that they were like, yes, this is better than what we could do ourselves.
Yeah, one of the challenges I think that a lot of bus maps have is there's actually only a relatively small number of colours you can use in the map that the eye can identify by sight. Like, you can have maybe two different shades of blue, mm-hmm. and you can see which is the dark and which is the light one. But if you have like four shades of blue, then suddenly you don't know which is which. And, you know, bus networks tend to be more than a dozen lines. So
yeah, I think for the truly gifted amateur map maker, bus maps are kind of the big challenge, really. Because in London, they sort of get around this by putting area-specific maps up in bus stops. But if you were trying to look at a whole bus map of London, you'd be confused.
I mean, there are literally hundreds of different bus routes run by the London Transport Authorities, and I think that's probably about standard for major cities. But, you know, I still come back to my point, which is if you really want to sort of make it as a map maker, what you need to do is invent your own colour.
You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Elledge and Barbara Speed and produced by Royful Brown. Our theme music is Dust from the Stars by Charlie Charles. You also heard The Weather by Destinazione Altrove and Embryonic Waves, composed by Matthew Reitzel. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast and on iTunes, where you'll also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. You can also talk to us on Twitter and on Facebook, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. And if you wanted to leave a review to tell your friends how lovely we are, well, we'd very much appreciate that. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.
Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.